Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
Main menu.
And welcome to the final main menu of 2004. Main menu will, of course, be back in 2005, so stay tuned to our website and mailing lists for announcements about future programmes, and I'm sure we'll be talking about the all-new JAWS version 6, released by Freedom Scientific last week. Main menu is ACB Radio's regular look at technology from a blindness perspective, made available to radio reading information services around the world, but first heard on ACB Radio Mainstream on Wednesdays at 1 Universal. That's Tuesday evenings in the United States, and during the US winter, that's 8 Eastern, 5 Pacific. Main menu's popularity is due to the grassroots approach we take to describing, demonstrating, and discussing technology, not just assistive technology, from a blindness perspective. And if you have an idea of an item you would like to hear on a future main menu, or perhaps you would like to be very brave and produce an item for a future main menu, then we would certainly welcome your input. Main menu is, of course, your program. And if you have any ideas, then do drop us a line. The address to write to is support@acbradio.org. support@acbradio.org, and we'd be delighted to hear from you. This week on the programme, a slightly longer main menu. The main menu should run for around about 90 minutes this week. We present a panel discussion held at the conclusion of the ICANN conference, which was held in Cape Town just at the start of December, ahead of the 6th General Assembly of the World Blind Union. Myself and Jeff Shang, also from ACB Radio, participated in the panel discussion, which attempts to explore the complex and often contentious issue of internet accessibility.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this special session. A joint session between ICANN and the World Blind Union. My name is Alan Levine. I'm the chairman of the Internet Society of South Africa. We recognize being based in Cape Town, where the ICANN meeting is being held this December, that the World Blind Union conference was happening concurrently to the ICANN conference in the same building. So at the last ICANN meeting, I mentioned this to John Clenson, who's sitting here on the panel with me, and he strongly suggested to me that we arrange some kind of joint session to talk about some internet accessibility. As far as I know, I believe this is one of the first joint sessions of its kind, and so I believe a very exciting event that I'm proud to welcome you to all attend. As a convener, I'm just welcoming you all here, but really my main job is just to introduce the chairman. We invited Amadeo Brill, who is both deeply involved in the ICANN movement and various of its operations or various entities that work within the ICANN involvement. Amadeo himself was a member of the board of ICANN, and he is also has only partially sighted. More recently, his vision has been somewhat improved through various operations. I believe when he started out in ICANN, he had around 10% in one eye. So he was the ideal person to chair this event. And without further ado, I hand you over to Amadeo.
Thanks a lot, Alan, for the invitation for organizing the meeting. So thanks a lot to you and the World Blind Union for organizing this joint session that, as you said, is one of the first of its kind for the World Blind Union, but also for ICANN, I think, in this world. And, we decided here that we'll make very short presentations from the four members of the panel, and that what we really want is to have a discussion with a lot of you regarding the issues you have with internet access, the ideas you may have for improving internet access, that sometimes it doesn't depend on the technology, but just on the implementation that we do that in the actual world. And the first, in this line, the first presentation will come from WinServ. WinServ is, in his civil life, let's say, he's the vice president for information strategy at MCI, but he's also the chairman of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, that has been holding the meeting here for this week, which deals with the coordination of some technical functions in the Internet. And he's also regularly designated as the father of the Internet, being the co-designer of the TCP/IP protocol. So, Vin, please, can you just start this session with your thoughts about accessibility in Internet today?
Thank you very much, Amadeo. Just to correct one thing, I'm not the only father of the Internet. There are lots of them. You don't get anything the scale of the Internet and the complexity of it without a lot of people working on it, but I appreciate very much the honor that you implied. I actually just want to make 3 points about the net. I mean, 2 points about the net and 1 point about technology and disabilities. Let me start with the technology and disability story. This is just an anecdote, but it's one which is personal and has meant a lot to me. I'm hearing impaired, and you can tell I'm wearing headphones because I get better sound that way than I do just with my hearing aids. So I'm not listening to a football game in the middle of the conference. My wife was born with normal hearing, but when she was 3 years old, she lost her hearing. She was profoundly deaf. It was a disease of some sort. She stayed profoundly deaf for almost 50 years. She used to lip read in order to understand what people were saying. And then in 1996, she got on the Internet and started looking around and learning about a technology called a cochlear implant. It's a piece of technology which is inserted inside the head. There are electrodes which are fed inside the cochlea to touch the auditory nerve and some electronics. An external computer called a speech processor is associated with the cochlear implant and is inductively connected to the electronics that are inside the head. Sound is brought in from a microphone and fed into a speech processor. The speech processor analyzes the frequencies that are present and decides which electrodes inside the cochlea it's going to stimulate in order to simulate what the brain would normally detect as sound. We know enough about sensory neural system, at least the auditory sensory neural system, to know how to make the brain think it's hearing sound by stimulating the auditory nerve directly. What's astonishing is that this is an outpatient operation. You go in the morning and you come home with a cochlear implant. It takes a few weeks to heal, and then you go back and the speech processor is activated. When my wife went back to have this activation done, after about 20 minutes of working on the program in the speech processor, she picked up the phone and she called me, and we had the first telephone conversation we had had in then 30 years of marriage. It wasn't a profound conversation, but it certainly was an important one. Of course, there were some side effects, and now I have a 61-year-old teenager at home. I can't get her off the telephone. She's always talking to her friends. For a while, she would be very happy to receive telephone solicitations because it gave her a chance to listen to different voices and to interact with them. Her favorite, I work for MCI. It's a telecommunications company in the United States. And her favorite calls would come from competitors like AT&T and Sprint. She would engage the telemarketer in a long conversation. How did you get your job? What do you like about it or not like about it? This could go on for 15 or 20 minutes. And then, of course, the solicitor would then say, well, Mrs. Cerf, are you willing to switch to AT&T? And she would say, well, actually, my husband's an executive in MCI, and I think I'll just stay with that service. But thanks for calling. She was determined to capture every decibel possible. No decibel would go unheard. So she got a lot of patch cables that would feed into an auxiliary input in her speech processor. When she goes on an airplane, she just connects a patch cable into the armrest and then plugs that into her speech processor. So when the movie is playing, the only sound she can hear is coming from the movie. If there is a screaming child next to her, she can't hear any of that because the only sound her brain is detecting is what the speech processor is feeding to it. She bought a tape recorder because she wanted to listen to recorded books for the blind. And the reason she wanted to do that is that she wanted to hear words that she knew how to read, but she didn't know how to pronounce because she'd never heard them before. So she called the library. And she said hello on the phone. She called the library and said, "Hello, I'm Sigrid, sir. I'd like to sign up for recorded books." And they said, "Fine, you know, what's your name, your phone number, and your address?" And then they said, "Now, you're blind, aren't you?" And she said, "No, I'm deaf." And there was a long pause while they were trying to figure out, well, how is this going to work? She's now listened to 490 books on tape. She listens to, she has a Sony Walkman patch cable. She uses infrared devices in movie theaters that transmit the soundtrack over an infrared channel, and that, again, plugs directly into her speech processor. Television sets similarly can be outfitted with infrared transmitters. She brings with her, in a situation like this, an FM transmitter with a microphone on it. She would attach that transmitter to one of the microphones here, and then she can sit anywhere in the room to receive an FM transmission with all of the sound coming directly to her. I could go on and on. I won't, but it's a wonderful story, and it's an impressive piece of technology. It's now standard practice in the United States. It used to be very experimental, but now it's considered a normal therapy for certain kinds of hearing loss. One can anticipate over time that there will be similar technologies for optical implants and maybe someday even spinal implants to deal with spinal cord injuries by having the electronic processor relay signals past a place in the spinal cord that's been damaged. So that story, apart from its heartwarming aspect, illustrates how much we now know about sensory neural functionality. We may someday also be able to deal with the ability to stimulate the muscular system in order to recover from various kinds of damage that prevent people from walking or that interfere with their ability to manipulate their hands. Let me switch to two other points, and then I hope I'm not going on too long. When we see the World Wide Web, or for some of you, when we hear the World Wide Web, we have access to an extraordinary collection of information. But the people who produce the information do not uniformly understand how many different modalities may be needed in order to make that information readily accessible and useful to everyone. And so I see a continuing need for creative use of these technologies, improved in guidance for how to make accessible web pages. And I understand that there are groups in the UK, I think of the group that produced the Bobby software, which does automatic analysis of web pages to figure out in what ways they are not satisfactorily accessible, and suggestions for improving that. There's another piece of technology on the internet which is relevant here. It started out as a development to help interconnect the telephone system with the internet. It basically, in its initial incarnation, it basically was intended to take a telephone number and map it into some place on the internet so a phone call could be routed from the ordinary telephone net or the wireless mobile net into some termination point anywhere in the internet world. Well, the technology for doing that also can refer to other modalities like printed material or web pages or other telephone numbers or paging devices or personal digital assistants. There are a variety of different ways in which we try to communicate with people. And for those people who have special communication needs, what's helpful is for the requirement to come, it's a voice call, except I'm deaf. What should happen is that my receiving system should know enough about my needs, because it's been configured that way, to know that it might need to run the sound through a speech understanding system that produces text, or divert the call to what we call relay operators in the United States, who will transcribe manually whatever is being said into textual material, and of course vice versa. If the receiving party can't speak, then that party would type, and the information is relayed and turned into audio for the hearing person on the other end. Or alternatively, if you can speak but you can't hear, then you should be able to speak directly to the caller. It's just that the information coming from the caller needs transcription. All of these transformations from one modality to another should be under the control of the recipient. And I see internet as a technology which may give us much more control over what happens to incoming communications. In the past, the caller or the originator of the communication chooses the modality. I'm going to send you a fax. I'm going to send you an email. But if you need to have those modalities changed, you should have the ability to control that. I need to listen to my email. I need to listen to a fax, and I'm not sure how we deal with that, and if it's a drawing, but if it's text, we can go from text to speech. So I see in the internet some real opportunities for adapting its very rich and different multiple communications modalities from one form to another, depending on the needs of the user. So, Mr. Chairman, I will stop there, and thank you very much for your patience in allowing me to go on as long as I have.
Okay, thanks a lot, Wint, for first explaining the always fascinating story of Sirit, and then for pointing to this need for pointing to this new technology and to the need to keep developing the technologies. But indeed, as you said, having the technology is not everything. We need then to implement them in a way that it's useful for each need. In this tract, one of the persons that can help us understand how this works is John Clancin, our next speaker, who looks quite alike to Mr. Wint, and also worked with him in MCI for some time, and after in AT&T, and before that as doing research at MIT. In the ICANN wall, he's most known for his standards development experience. He's been the chair of the Internet Architecture Board, which is the top group in deciding the Internet standards. But he also has an impressive track record in actual product design and development in very different areas. I don't know whether he also in Internet accessibility areas, John.
Thank you. And to your question, not significantly, although I worked with and helped set up W3C's accessibility group back in the early days. When Alan invited me to participate in this, we got started on a bit of a conversation about what governments and governance can do to help these technologies along. And I'm afraid I exploded. And Alan said, well, that's just what we need to hear, although it'll be very controversial. So I want to say a few words about that, and then I think we'll continue with discussion. My observation has been that while basic accessibility legislations are very important and very useful, what tends to happen after that is that governments and governance bodies tend to get extremely good at specifying particular technologies and lose sight of real goals and objectives. And that process of specifying particular technologies in turn often leads to a situation in which the wrong technologies get specified and the right ones get blocked. I think I've seen a number of situations in which we've had technologies mandated with the best of intentions that have then proceeded to make it hard for those technologies to be deployed and harder for newer and better technologies to emerge. Interestingly enough, while I'm not significantly visually impaired, I use a tiny laptop because I get tired of the big ones. And I use screen reader software on this laptop, both at the magnifying variety and at the sound producing variety, in order to be able to see the screen when I'm working late at night and half exhausted, or to read the screen. So this is an interesting situation in which technologies which are developed for people who are significantly visually impaired turn out to be very useful for those of us who are not. And areas in which products can be developed that way are areas in which products become deployable, in which mainstream vendors see a lot of profitability in development of really good stuff that's useful across the line, and which is sustainable and developable because it is interesting and profitable in the marketplace and can be implemented, rather than because a quasi-governmental body has said, go do something specific, which may or may not be possible, but until you can get there, you can do nothing. So as I say, I think we've seen from governmental mandates of specifics a great many solutions that are ultimately nothing or worse. And I prefer to see efforts going into areas where we can figure out what to do about these technologies to reverse or ameliorate the impact of various trends. I've been worried about the web and HTML readers for a number of years because some work in other areas has convinced me that they are possibly the solution to the wrong problem, and that a better solution to that class of problems is a different way of looking at things. A great deal of work was done many years ago in what was originally called agent programs, things whose purpose was to act as the user's agent under user control for doing various things. Terminology in more recent years has come to mean something else and something much more specialized. But what we discovered in that area was that if you started designing computer systems around the notion that users should be able to build things which interface to the underlying software, make things easier to use for them or more tailored to their particular needs, and you completely generalize this, you could build agents on top of agents on top of agents using the same kinds of tools and made that user accessible, that we ended up with a model in which the lowest level interfaces were really pretty simple and pretty easy to put different kinds of higher level user interfaces on top of. And that tended to produce a much more satisfactory experience both for those of us who had good sight and good hearing and good typing skills, and for those of us who, for one reason or another, did not, because we ended up using different interfaces on top of the same functionality. And that turned out to be extremely satisfactory as an idea for all of us, much more satisfactory than trying to take what is basically designed around the visual interface and throw away some of the information and then try to read the rest. The markup of HTML makes that a little bit easier than interpreting pure graphics, but it's not as good as if we're designing around a different model. And this is an example of my concern about regulators getting into the act, because if the focus turns out to be on making certain one can read HTML, then one may be focusing on the wrong kind of question relative to taking a different look at how to design layered and variant user interfaces for different kinds of needs, whether those be accessibility or convenience for different kinds of tasks. And I think that's probably where I should stop. We should get some discussion.
Thanks a lot, Vin. Sorry, John. Regarding what you said about the legislation, I don't know, the experience in the United States and other places. In my part of the world, the European Union, some countries have legislation. The European Union is even considering now, and they have issued a communication that will be published by the beginning of 2005. They're still open for input, and perhaps I will provide the URL for putting that in the minutes of this session. Regarding this, the reality is that they make probably two mistakes. The first one is mandating concrete technologies, and the second one is forgetting getting any implementation after passing the legislation, and that's been the main case in Europe so far. So the next speaker is not from the usual ICANN crowd, let's say, but indeed is a person deeply involved in the internet and the information technology in general. He is, let's say, our local guy. He's Hein Wagner from Cape Town, from South Africa. He is also, besides a person with a strong internet and technology background, he's also blind. And besides that, apparently he has a strong taste for all sorts of sports like marathon running, climbing, yachting, and cricket, that apparently is considered a sport in some parts of the world. I really have problems to understand that, but probably we'll chat about that later on. On the technology side, he works for Thauta, the security company, in certification and other areas. He has done many different roles so far in this company, but today I think he's international sales manager based here in Cape Town.
Thank you very much. I guess I wanted to share my personal experience with the technology. And it goes back many years. When I was still at school, I used to start playing around with computer technology and just wanting to find out how this all works and, you know, how it could possibly mean something for me. But I guess the big change was probably about 10 years ago when I, for the first time, was able to use voice technology. I mean, if I say voice technology, John touched on it briefly earlier, we're using a voice synthesizer on the computer that basically reads back whatever's on the screen to you as the blind person or whoever wants to listen. And for the first time, you know, I was working as a switchboard operator and I just wanted to do more with my life. And for the first time back in 1995, 96, I could go into the internet. I could read my daily or the front page of the daily newspaper. I didn't have to wait for somebody else to read it to me and to decide what I want to read or what I would like to hear. And from that point, it significantly changed my life where, you know, I could use technology to today, you know, work in a very competitive environment for, you know, one of the largest internet security companies in the world, competitively as an international sales manager. Now, you know, John also mentioned earlier technologies that developed through disability or through various needs in a disability world. And I would like to point out a few of those. You know, I stand to be corrected, but I think that the first document scanner, desktop scanner that most of you use today to scan photographs, was designed to actually scan an image and take that image, OCR, character recognition, and put it on a desktop or on the computer of a blind person so you can actually read the letter that arrived in the mailbox outside at your street address. Now, these days, everybody else used them for scanning photographs, etc. I also know that voice technology or voice recognition software was designed for people without hands, and today all the lazy professionals that do have hands use it to dictate to their computers because they're too lazy to type. So, you know, I think that the technology is certainly, people with disabilities, you know, it's inspired quite commodities in certain ways where I think the market would, you know, are interested in investing more in that. That's why we see more and more technology coming to the fore. I guess one of the challenges for me working on the internet every day and utilizing it in a security environment, my biggest challenge is websites that are badly designed or not designed people not using HTML tags and tags on the site so that you can actually navigate around. You know, from a technology point of view, you know, I guess we don't expect anybody or every single web page out there to be designed inclusively so that blind people can use them. But if you want to buy something from an organization online and the web form is not designed in such a way that you can actually read the fields or the voice synthesizer can't read them back to you, there's not a chance that I'm going to buy anything from them, right? I guess that poses a number of problems, and you know, I'm definitely not an expert on the level of how one could move forward, and I think an opportunity like this to discuss these issues and see, you know, what we can do working together to try and put, you know, maybe regulations in place to ensure that these kind of things happen. It's a big challenge because a very small percentage of the online community happens to be blind people.
If I may interrupt for a moment, a very large percentage of the online community is lazy people. And if we can work together, we may all be better off.
You're right, John. Okay, so our last speaker is Mr. Dave Williams from United Kingdom. and he runs ACB Radio, an internet radio station that in fact is broadcasting the World Blind Union conference starting tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. So he's a proof of that text is not everything on the internet right now, and that there are many different technologies that converge in bringing information, even if we are still always thinking that the web-based information is the biggest part of the internet, which it is indeed. But as I said, Dave Williams is in this case trying to use this technology to spread voice-based contents over it. So Dave, you can explain your interactions with the internet.
The difficulty is, I think somebody once said that the great thing about standards is that there are so many of them. And I think that's a key point. And I can identify with many of the comments that Hein made in relation to being able to access particular areas of the internet with particular software. And of course, there's always this question of who takes responsibility for improving that situation. Is it the responsibility of the manufacturer of the browser, or the content provider, or the assistive technology developer? And I think the reality is that the vast majority of blind internet users are Windows users, and the vast majority of those are using software which converts content, website content, into a form that's listenable. When you load a page, immediately you visually see the whole of that page, and you gain a lot of information about the layout of the page and the content that exists on the page. A blind person has to listen to the page in an audio format, which by its very nature is a linear form of delivery. You can't straight away have an idea of the page and what's there. So many screen reader packages now will tell you when you load a page how many links, how many tables, how many frames, how many forms, how many headings. That's assuming that the author has used headings, tables, and etc. So what do? Well, I run an internet radio project which is funded by the American Council of the Blind, who are a consumer movement of blind people in the United States. The project was established about 5 years ago by the previous director of ACB Radio, Jonathan Mosen from New Zealand, who now works with Pulse Data International. The objective really was to run a station and to provide information and entertainment for blind people, but the providers would themselves be blind also. There are other communities have their own radio stations. There are, in the UK where I live, there are community stations aimed at the Asian community. There are community stations aimed at other special interest groups. We felt that there was a blind community emerging online. Blind people had access to the internet for about 5 years at this point, so I guess I've been online now for about 10 years. And this community had sort of started to evolve, people communicating with each other around the world, sharing common experiences, and also wanting to connect with their blind brothers and sisters in other countries. And so ACB Radio was born, and a fairly straightforward project, and I'll be the first to admit our website is fairly diabolical. And my research in replacing our website with something that's going to be more consistent and more accessible has given me an insight into what our users need, what our listeners need, and certainly also what our volunteers, of which we have about 60 in 8 countries around the world, who contribute content to ACB Radio, which we then play for the benefit of all blind people who have access to the internet. And what I've discovered really is that there is no fix, you know, there is no one box solution. But I think the thing that blind people don't want is segregation. They don't want to have a specialist text-only site that's aimed at them. They want to be using the same information and the same interface that a sighted person would use, as much as possible. And I think that's very important, because the moment you start separating out these sites, and you say we have a site for people who can only use text and people who have a different browser and whatever it may be. We're in an age now where people access the internet on their mobile phones. People access the internet through their televisions with set-top boxes. I'm sure it won't be long before people can access the internet using their watch. It's possible to access the internet dialing a telephone number in the UK and hearing an audio version of the internet online, and you can use the keys on your telephone keypad to access web pages via the telephone. And I think what we need to keep in mind is universal design, because a web designer, you know, they just want to get their content out there, really. And that's the most important thing. And the tools that they use to do that, I think it's important that they insist on accessibility. We have seen progress in this area. People like Macromedia have made some progress with things like Dreamweaver, and they've included some accessibility options. But I think any content that is generated with a development tool or using a content management system, I think we need to talk to those guys and say, look, guys, your output has to meet certain universal standards in order for not just blind people, but people using mobile devices, people who are dyslexic, people who are colorblind. There are 180 million blind people in the world, and they're just the people that the World Blind Union knows about. Add to that the millions of people that suffer with sequencing disabilities. We are an aging population. More and more people are living longer, and typically people who are blind tend to be older people. I guess Hein and I are not really representative of the majority, being sort of younger guys, but people over the age of 60, over the age of 70, more of us are going to become blind in the future. And I would imagine that there will be delegates who have been here this week who at some stage will lose sight. So there are not just ethical and social reasons for doing this. There are, somebody mentioned also earlier, the sort of the legal situation and the role of government and the concern about, you know, how much do you try and regulate what's going on. And I mean, generally I'm quite opposed to regulation. I think you have to replace regulation with education and let people know what it is they need to do and why they need to do it. And I think one of the key arguments in that is the business argument. People with disabilities have a disposable income too, and if you make your service accessible to people with disabilities and you make it universally accessible to people using mobile devices and people accessing the internet in weird and wonderful exotic ways, then you're increasing your potential market, you're increasing your potential audience. And I think if the business community can adopt universal standards, then I do think others will follow. They'll see the advantage of that. I'm happy to hang around following this event if anybody wants to talk to me. I have access to several thousand blind people, many of whom I'm sure would be willing to participate in any sort of consultative exercise. I'm not clear how this panel will continue. Somebody said that this was the first thing of its kind, and I sincerely hope that if nothing else, that this endeavour doesn't die today. I hope that we can repeat this at some time, or we can set up a steering group or some kind of body or initiative to really raise awareness of this issue, because it's a vitally important issue, especially in view of the fact that many of us in years to come will become blind.
Thanks a lot, Dave. So now we open this for discussion from the floor, and there is a couple of mics, wireless microphones that are around, so I'll ask you just to raise your hand and somebody will come close to you with a microphone. In the meantime, I just have a question here for the panelists. I think that what we were talking now, right now, are just the web pages, and you know, the problem is that maybe we have the standards and the good intentions, but people do strange, lousy implementations of that. My problem is when I point that regularly to the webmasters that keep doing strange things, that, you know, text in columns with tables and frames, and when they try to increase the size well beyond what they expected, so I am able to read that, or use a reader, it's impossible because everything gets mixed, or they use not pure text, but just, let's say, bitmap or graphics as text, in fact. They don't know what I'm talking about. They say, well, I tested with Internet Explorer, it works. And that's all, yeah. And what I think it's important this time is instead of Amadeo and the designer spending countless hours discussing what's, you know, this technology and the other, because none of us know, to be able to point to good primers of how internet design, so web design should be done so it's accessible. I think the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, Web Accessibility Initiative has some of this material. I don't know whether there are others. I think it would be helpful to have a small collection to touch here, so all of the members of WBU, when they have problems, they can simply point to the page where the webmaster will be able to check what he's supposed to do for making his website accessible.
Can I make a comment about the Web Accessibility Initiative guidelines? I think that they are a great starting point. Tools like Bobby, while they are quick and relatively easy for a web designer to use in terms of auditing their website for accessibility, do have their limitations. You mentioned graphics, and one of the key things that the Web Accessibility Initiative guidelines recommends is that whenever there is content that is graphical, that the web designer should endeavour to make that information available in an alternative format, because it's quite possible that the user may not be able to display or access the graphic for whatever reason, not just for reasons relating to disability, but there may be technological reasons, there may be bandwidth reasons why one may have graphics turned off in the browser. So whenever one, and that's something that's recommended, but I think you've got to be sensible about this and think that in actual fact, yes, if there is a photograph of Table Mountain, you want to be told that there is a photograph of Table Mountain and maybe given some information or a link to find out more, what, you know, to a description of that. But if there is some what they call web page furniture, so you have a small graphic that perhaps is a white space or perhaps is there for cosmetic reasons, it's not always necessary, I don't think, to label all of those graphics. So I think it's important that while some of these tools like Bobby, you know, they do have their uses, they're not a panacea, they're not going to completely sort out the problem. And I go back to this point about education, and that somebody who's planning to launch a large website and they're expecting to have users that have disabilities or users accessing their site with other technologies other than, you know, Internet Explorer or whatever it may be, that they get a focus group, some real people using some real technologies in a real world situation. We've talked today in quite theoretical terms, and it seems to me that we do need to focus on some of these more practical issues.
Yes, sorry, Vin has the floor and then someone in the first row.
Thank you very much, Amadeo. I just had one observation to make about other than web kinds of enablement, even though that's an important medium for us and it delivers a great deal of information. Some of us have an abiding interest in putting devices onto the Internet and then making them Internet-enabled so that they can accept control from the Internet. Let me give you a small example, a video cassette recorder or perhaps another appliance at home, even something as simple as a refrigerator or an oven or something like that. Now, once you put something on the net and once you program it to accept external controls, it's possible to make it speech-enabled by sending speech to a computer that is able to understand it. And that computer then sends whatever, you know, interprets the speech and then takes whatever action is appropriate, including activating a video cassette recorder, turning ovens on and off. Now, the reason I suggest this is that it creates a almost universal environment in which you can manage a great many devices that you would otherwise have to be in the same room with, have to know how to aim a remote controller towards with an infrared beam. And I think that in the long run, we may see ways of significantly improving our ability to manage these devices using speech understanding technology and networking technology to make that possible.
here in the first floor.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Sheng. I'm actually Dave Williams, a colleague from ACB Radio, and I'm from Australia, so it's a bit of an international thing happening here with ACB Radio. I wanted to pick up on one thing that Dave was talking about and give a couple of examples, I think, because I know that you all, you know, do lots of work in policy, but you also have jobs that, you know, do with things on the ground, and perhaps some concrete examples of some problems might be more useful. Dave was talking about things like, you know, the pixel graphics and the white spaces and things like that. And that's an example, really, of where people not causing alt tags has actually caused a rather significant problem. Back in the sort of mid-90s, you know, we were all starting to do all this sort of thing. A lot of screen readers, you know, ignored a lot of the graphics entirely because they said, you know, felt that they didn't really add any information, and the way things were designed generally then, that was mostly the case. But then we started to get a lot of sites where alt tags were not being used, and for things like navigation and for section headers and things like that, graphics were being used instead. And the screen reader people, and also I use a text-only browser, and a lot of the same issues that screen reader writers have, they also have there, because ultimately you're looking for a textual representation of a website. These people started thinking, these sites are these graphics are important. We need to know what they are. The only way we can really provide this information is to display or make available the name of the graphic file that's being called, and hopefully this will be something meaningful. And in a lot of cases it is. And then a few years ago, about, you know, 5 years ago, there started to be this propensity for things like pixel GIFs and spacer GIFs, and, you know, and I've even come across nothing.gif. Great. So whilst it's not necessary for these things to be alt tagged, and in fact I have seen places where people have put an alt tag of spacer, you know, spacer. If it's not meant to be heard, or it's meant to be seen, it shouldn't be meant to be heard either. Some of these file names and these little things are not only sort of annoying, but because due to their nature, there's often a lot of them. They can get extremely tiring. Now, on some of these screen readers, you can turn this facility off, but you do run the risk of not being able to hear a graphic that you actually really need, because there isn't a common universal approach to these things. So my advice to people, when you're having these, you know, elements that are there to create space or to sort of decorate the page but really don't offer anything, is to have an alt tag that's empty, and then we don't get anything. Now, this is obviously a case where people not using alt tags to begin with has created this problem, but it is where we are today, and unfortunately that's how it is. And I'm not sure whether the copious use of spaces and blanks are going to go away sooner or later. I suspect that they're starting to wane now. I don't really know, but it is something to be aware of. Dave and I were discussing things to talk about at this session, and two things that one area that is a bit of a concern for blind people is the area of security, and I'll give you two examples that are a bit of a problem for us. One of them is where you've got services like, for example, like Yahoo or PayPal or whatever, where you've got to sign up, and they're wanting to avoid having automated processes be able to sign up and abuse their system. So they have something like a graphic, and they get you to copy down a number that's in the graphic. And that's all very well if you can see the graphic. But it's no jolly good if you can't see the graphic. And we appreciate why they're doing it. If the text for it is in the code, then the little web robot will just extract it from the code and put it in the form where it's needed, and it completely defeats the purpose. But there need to be other mechanisms. Now, PayPal have an audio file that can be used. It's deliberately kind of obscured a bit so that I don't know how far do you take these things. I don't know how many people do it, but it's obviously there so that any voice recognition software would have difficulty. Unfortunately, this also means that human beings often have difficulty. I'm a young person who has, I think, quite good hearing, and I had to listen to the thing about 6 or 7 times and try about 4 or 5 different combinations before I got the one that would work. And as Dave said, people are getting older, and acquiring their blindness at older ages. And I think also we'll be finding that people who are older will be using technologies like the internet into older age. And so whereas, you know, I struggled a bit but got there, I think other people will have difficulty. My other experience was Yahoo, trying to sign up for them. They say, "Oh, give us your phone number and we will call you." But I'm not in the United States, and I shouldn't have to give them my phone number anyway. I hold my phone number very dear because we know how, one of our speakers before spoke about solicitations, and we all get enough of those without flashing our phone number around, and we kind of reduce the thing to do that. So I'm not quite sure what the answer is, but it's a problem that needs to be thought about. It's something that works for everybody, and certainly someone who is deafblind is not going to be able to listen to a file or even necessarily very easily talk to someone on a phone. And the other issue that I've come across, and then I'll shut up, is the issue of things like security for internet banking. Dave and I have been discussing this the last couple of days because the services that I use and the services he uses have vastly different security requirements. And I suppose that's a policy for various companies. But certainly a couple of banks in Australia, and my flatmate belongs to a bank where this at least was the case. I mean, we haven't gone bank to check for fairly obvious reasons. They're so paranoid about people having spyware on your machine that will intercept keystrokes or intercept mouse clicks, that they actually have a floating keyboard that moves around the screen, and you've got to click the letters on the keyboard with your mouse to be able to enter your password or word or whatever. So basically you've got to be able to see, and you've got to be fairly dexterous to be able to make this happen. And that's, you know, so wrong for so many reasons. And they have they've instituted electronic banking accessibility guidelines in the last few years, and internet ones were one of them, and these things are looking to are highly discouraged now as part of these guidelines. But, you know, implementation is the thing, and certainly last time we checked this hadn't been fixed. And I don't know, I think the whole question of security needs to be looked at and try and find ways where things are as secure as they need to be, but also take the needs of lots of different people into account. And yeah, there are blind people quite happy to look at your sites just as individuals, and there are also people who do consultancy in this area, and they're very good, and they cover these things well, and they will give you detailed feedback on what needs to be fixed and how.
I think we have some good and bad news for you. There are other communities and other technological changes which will inevitably help with some of these problems. The overloading of decoration of web pages for its own sake has the side effect that unless one has infinite cheap bandwidth, those web pages start downloading very slowly. And we're beginning to see trends, even among people who have no trouble dealing with the web pages once they get them, that the frustration level begins to rise. And if somebody's given a choice between dealing with a web page from an organization that will actually deliver the web page to them and seeing a web page from a competing organization that managed to deliver it so slowly that it feels like, to use the old phrase, the worldwide wait, they begin to make market choices. And those market choices, I think, will eventually tend to reinforce the same judicious use of images and appropriate labeling of those images that benefits you and your circumstances for wanting the same thing. Curiously enough, there's arguably an HTML flaw there. That is, that alt is not quite the right mechanism, and sooner or later we're going to have to figure out a way to design ourselves out of that. A similar observation applies to these security measures, which is there's ample evidence that both the tricky graphics, which are often as hard for a fully sighted person to decipher as you find the tricky audio, and the tricky audio will eventually yield to smarter crackers along with the moving keyboards and the rest. And my guess is those are going to turn out to be relatively short-lived technologies. Now, whether their replacements are going to be something worse or whether the problems are going to be dealt with in some more serious way still is undetermined at best. And I think we can hope that your community and other communities who are getting just a little bit tired of these quick patches which make the internet inaccessible can begin to work together on solutions which work much better and are much more secure for all of us.
I mean, I don't know whether you have anything to add on the security technologies and the friendship of these services for all types of users.
From a digital certificate perspective, you know, fortunately, through most browsers and voice technology, it is accessible in terms of seeing who signed which certificate authority signed the certificate. So that doesn't pose a major problem. You can at least see who you're dealing with. You know, obviously with IDNs, it doesn't really affect my world, but with internationalized domain names, there's going to be some different challenges, I'm sure, but that's fortunately just in the future. So no, I don't really have, from a security perspective, any additional comment.
Just one question for John and Dave and all the others, in fact. When we're discussing about, John started with some skepticism about legislation or regulation of this area, and Dave echoed that in the sense that what we need is, you know, a sense of awareness of, you know, making the business model and letting them understand that if not accessible, their services will be, you know, choice of the way, the people will move to other services. The only problem is that I'm not completely convinced that this always works. That is, awareness and making those providing the services aware of the problems they are creating on the part of the population is important. But not always the market mechanism will work. And I'll tell you why. I come from a minority of a minority of a minority. For instance, I'm using services and then I have problems because A, I use a Macintosh and not a Windows machine. B, I don't see that well. C, I speak Catalan, and perhaps other languages, but not everybody speaks other languages. D, there are legal barriers for some services like financial services, etc. So, the people having trouble in a given place may be, let's say, marginal somehow to some of these players, and they perhaps will not pay attention. So I think that still there is some room in this scenario where you have many fragmented, let's say, marginal communities that don't add up for a given services, for some role of regulation. And what I would like seeing in the future is more, let's say, secondary type of regulation. It's not the regulator saying you have to do this, but mandating technologies, this is a mistake, perhaps mandating certification. That is, mandating that if you want to provide given services, you have to prove that you got the seal of approval of the entities that check that your site is accessible. And I don't know whether this would be an approach that would be more palatable to or more useful in your view, John or Dave.
I would think yes. And again, I'm very much in favor of basic enabling and accessibility of legislation as long as it concentrates on what one is trying to accomplish rather than on the technology. It's the technology where I think we get ourselves into trouble.
I think legislation can be useful. The problem I think that we have right now is that certainly in the UK and the US is that the legislation... I don't really think that this legislation has been tested to its fullest extent. The sorts of language that's used in these kinds of pieces of legislation are things like reasonable adjustment, which are open to interpretation. And I think therein lies the problem. And I think legislation can be useful, but to start from scratch with new legislation or to try and persuade governments to toughen up the existing legislation when they've just passed disability legislation, I think is going to be a very slow process. And I think we need to look at a range of incentives for web designers. Clearly there are legal... certainly if you're providing public service, you do now have to make that service... You have to make reasonable adjustments to that service. You know, a bank could quite easily say, well, you know, we can help you conduct this transaction over the phone, you know, so we're offering you another way to access the service, but that doesn't solve the problem because the website, you know, the website is still a disgrace. So I think we need to look at a range of incentives, you know, including business incentives, legal incentives and ethical and social reasons that that all come together, really, that I think make a very compelling argument for anybody providing a service via the internet to make sure that they can offer that service to the widest possible audience.
I wonder if I could augment that just a little bit. I'm persuaded that the ability to cope with multiple interaction means is pretty important. I sit on the board of a company called Nuance, which makes speech understanding software. There's nothing that stops us from using speech on the internet. In fact, if you're following it, you know that voice over IP is becoming a very popular means of carrying sound on the network for parties to communicate with each other. When you add to that the ability to do speech understanding, you start to have an opportunity to create web pages that are designed for voice interaction. What we discovered very quickly in the Nuance environment is that if you were designing a web page for speech interaction, it had to be differently designed, and I think this point came up earlier today. I want to just emphasize that it's not simply a matter of taking a website and trying to augment it with alt text underneath the imagery and the like. Sometimes you really have to think your way through what makes sense for audio interaction. Unfortunately, not all applications and not all designers think about alternative modalities for interaction. And so there's a place where legislation might conceivably help. I do have one obvious example. In the late 1970s, this is before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, I worked with the Department of Health and Human Services on captioned television. There was quite a debate about which technology made sense. And they ended up with the lesser of the two technologies that were competing with each other, but it was one which could be put into the systems much quicker. This is what's known as Line 21 captioning. What was interesting about that piece of legislation is that it mandated that all television sets in the United States, sold in the United States, after a certain period of time, had to have automatic closed captioning interpretation. That's turned out to be very helpful, and I use it all the time. John Clenson will know about an application, a surprising application that arose out of the effect of doing the captioning, and that's the ability to capture the text of the captions as well as the imagery, build an archive, search the text for a particular piece of material, and then find the associated video. So if you had archives of movies or archives of news reports, that you could use Google-like search engines on the text from captioning and then discover the video segment that goes with it. So I don't mean to suggest that any of this is trivial, and it does require investment to make these different modalities work, and sometimes the only way to force companies to do that is to legislate. The opposite side of this, of course, is that if you force companies to do things that make the companies uneconomic, eventually they go out of business and then no one wins. So there's a balance that one has to find between the legislative requirement and the practicality of doing it.
Okay, so our next question for the floor.
Pretty much things that Dave's already touched on and Vince just mentioned now as well. I think more than legislation, you need to have incentives. As Vin said, you know, if things cost money to produce, sort of, now we need to spend longer time developing a website with the correct tags or the correct structure. What is the incentive to spend that extra money? The incentive obviously needs to be somehow the site needs to be better known, that it's accessible for the blind, for other people, other communities, and so it gets a better hit rate. How to get that incentives going, I think that's something needs to be looked at possibly. Also, I think one needs to look at educating the developers of today. Recently in South Africa, a few weeks ago, we were talking about standards amongst Java and all the different kinds of Java that's out there at the moment and how certain websites weren't working. Clearly, I guarantee that pretty much 99% of the developers developing sites these days have no idea about the standards that are required for websites for accessibility with these tags. I think it's more of an educational thing that needs to be done to educate the developers, be it in the colleges and in the books that are educating guys how to develop the sites. I think those are things that need to be addressed as well.
Just from an incentive point of view, you know, I had an experience with one of our big retailers that went online a couple of years ago. I don't want to mention their name, but I refer to their website as Pick and Pray. And one of the problems was, you know, having to find, if you select a couple of items that you want to buy, the delivery time seems to be a problem. And what we did is I called them up, and they were very open to the change. So I don't think it's all negative. And maybe if one could start to use those as examples, you know, where people are prepared to work with the community to try and resolve these kind of issues, I think that might be some form of incentive for some of our retailers and online traders.
Hi, I'm John Crane, Chief Technical Officer at ICANN. I hear a lot about websites, and really I'm also interested in hearing if there are problems with other applications, particularly things like email and the email clients that are out there. As a fully sighted, well, when I've got my glasses on, fully sighted person, I find it sometimes hard enough to find my way around some of the email clients that are out there at the moment. They have about 50 million buttons, all of which do nothing. And when you actually want to do something like bounce an email, it's impossible. So I was wondering if there were also issues around there. And then my second question is, what would be a good resource that we could point people to, including my own webmasters and people who are developing tools, to go and look and find out about this? I did a Google search and found 2.4 million pages, because unfortunately I look for websites for the blind, and with the word website in there I get about 7 billion replies, of course. So the two questions really are, what are the other applications that are important to you, and where do I find out about how to develop them properly?
Hi, this is Dave Williams from ACB Radio, and I'm certainly not in a few seconds going to be able to answer your questions in any depth, and I'd very much like the opportunity to speak with you further. I would answer your second question first. Blind people are using a range of applications, mainstream applications, specialist applications. I use audio production software. Obviously, you know, I use sort of standard email and office type applications. Also use things like SSH, and so I think it's important that people are aware that, you know, blind people aren't just using a very small subset of software. I think the only area really that blind people haven't really made many inroads in is are things like computer-aided design, you know, applications that are clearly designed for, you know, for a visual purpose, but certainly accounting type applications. Blind people are lawyers, or, you know, they're accountants, they're audio engineers. Blind people are out there and are in all walks of life. I guess the focus of this panel discussion really has been more toward the internet, obviously it being ICANN and all, but certainly blind people are using other applications. And in terms of access to things like your email client, I think generally application developers, particularly for the Windows platform, are to some extent restricted in the amount that they can do based on the SDKs that Microsoft make available. That providing an application uses standard Windows controls, screen reading software can comfortably access that software. There are issues, without a doubt, but I think where the internet is different is that much more flexibility is given to the provider.
You may add something to John's question. Well, I repeat, I'm not blind. I still have eyesight problems. It might be more serious or less serious in, you know, my past history. My experience is that my problems with email have been nothing compared to my problems with, you know, access to information on the website. Normally, I can tell my email client to reformat anything to ASCII, and from that, making any size or having that read on voice for me, it's okay. Then the problem I have is language, because I receive emails in different languages, and my machine refuses to understand that there are different languages. But that's a different problem indeed. Two other things here. The first is, you know, for instance, regarding web access, one of the solutions they had for all these strange sites that use columns in not very standard format and they cannot increase the size to, you know, my preferred way, is in case they provide RSS feeds to use whenever possible RSS readers, that is, readers that grab the text and the XML format of the text and they bring it to me, indeed, once again, in my preferred typeface and size without any of this website furniture, even if there are some enclosures like images or sound sometimes, but they are useful up to now. And then, this I repeat, I can read it because it's put in the way I can read it, or it can be just read to me by the machine. The problem I have with sound, which is very useful as an alternative, is that as far as I know, the search technologies within sound files are not as refined, indeed, as they are in, you know, text on HTML. And I don't know whether any of you can point to any useful tools for searching within the contents of, you know, be that MP3 or any other format, because this is one of the problems I have with long text, that I prefer just scanning that visually to, or just to look with the search function for the terms in the part that is interesting to me, and if I have all that to be read to me by the computer, I cannot search that easily.
I'd like to make a couple of points about the whole things like the email and so on. There seems to me to be two types of information, and one of them is where the interface to that is defined by the client, and the other one is defined more defined by the people who are providing the information. Now, email falls into the first category. You know, if you there's quite a lot of email clients out there, so most people can usually find one that suits their needs, or if they really have the expertise, they can write their own. Certainly, being a Linux user, I'm not using Outlook or Eudora or any of these things. I'm quite happy to use Pine and have been doing so for 10 years. And I don't feel that I'm missing out, except on some of those pesky viruses. Email and news groups and FTP and a few other things are very much, there's an underlying protocol, and the way that that's rendered to the user is in the control of the client-side software. Things like websites are a little bit in between, because the browser does have, the accessibility issues within itself, but it can only make things as accessible as the client-side program is. After that, if there are issues, then that's dealt with by the content. Same for things like PDF documents. Up until relatively recently, it's been difficult for people to be able to access the Acrobat Reader, but there are now screen readers that can do that. But it doesn't automatically mean that you can read every PDF document, or that even if you can, like, for example, blind people have taken to mobile phones like duct tape to water, because there's lots of useful things. It means that on the most basic level, it means that if you're out and about, you don't have to try and find a public phone, which, of course, is hard enough for many people these days, because they're disappearing. But at least if you can see one, you can get to it. Lots of people like mobile phones, but some of the mobile phone manuals online will have graphic representations of buttons that need to be pushed at key stages of operations. And when you go to read this, it says, press that button. And it's like, which jolly button? And you've got no way. So The things that are the bigger issue, as far as I can see, are the things where the layout and content, the appearance, the access, the interface to the information is defined by the people who provide the information. This was a point made fairly early by one of our speakers, is that the way you receive the information needs to be controllable at your end. And I would very much endorse that position.
I wonder if I could surf again. Thanks very much for that wonderful story about finding public phone booths that are disappearing. It occurs to me that the same theory that lets us imagine speech-enabled devices that were not originally designed to be controlled by speech might apply to the mobile phones. And the mobile instruments are becoming sufficiently powerful that they might easily be capable of understanding speech, or at least for command purposes trained to understand your voice. But in the absence of that, you can imagine saying something into the instrument and having that information flow to a speech understanding system elsewhere on the net, and then actions taken appropriately because the understanding was done in a shared processor somewhere. So I think that the problem, of course, is that the interface needs to be designed to accept things like that. This isn't terribly different than the problem that arises when you want to have multiple interfaces to the same underlying function. You have these graphical point-and-click kinds of interfaces, and then you hope that there's also a command line style interface available. The reason that you might be interested in that is you want program control over the software as opposed to human pointing and clicking. But if program control is required, it also offers an opportunity to deal with the problem you're describing.
One of the reasons why I like Linux is that I do like command lines, and it's quite refreshing to me that there's quite a lot of Linux users out there in the general community who also prefer the text mode interface. So it means that not all the new applications that are being developed in the open source world are graphical. There are still text mode things, you know, being written. You know, I use a text mode MSN Messenger client, which is beautiful to use. I use, you know, text mode this and that. And also, they're often power users, and they want to be able to put them in, you know, Bash scripts or Perl scripts or, you know, things like that to automate, you know, daily functions or whatever you want to do. Back to the mobile phone thing, and this is often a common misconception. For blind people, the issue usually is not the issue of getting information into your device, it's getting information out. The number of times I've had people say to me, "So do you use dictation software on your computer?" It just astounds me. It sounds like someone told them all at birth that that's what we do. Most of us can type just fine and are proud of the fact that we can, because it's a very effective and quick interface to get text into a computer. The issue that we have is getting information out, and that's why we have speech output software. And in fact, Dave and I are both using Symbian phones that have speech output software on them. So that's opened up access to things like SMS, text messaging, checking email by phone, and in recent versions of it, you know, access to WAP, which is great. You know, you might have if you go to a railway station, you might not be able to read the timetables, but if you can dial up the website on your phone, you can check out when the next train's coming. And that sort of thing is going to be fantastic, and it's going to be, I think, as revolutionary for blind people now as access, you know, mobile phones in themselves, in and of themselves, were when they first came onto the market.
So is there any other question or comment from the audience?
Doesn't look like it, Amadeo. I think they're all absorbing.
Any final remarks from the panelists? I think that Dave and Hay.
Yeah, I would reiterate a point that I've made earlier. I think we've only really sort of scratched the surface of a small subset of some of the issues which concern access to information technology by people with disabilities. And clearly there are some ideological differences in the room, and there are some technological differences in the room. But I think the one thing that we all have in common is the fact that we were willing to turn up today, and unlike the majority of the ICANN delegates, we haven't all gone shark diving this afternoon. And I think it's important that this doesn't end here. We really must work together, the disability community and the internet community, to try and, you know, there is responsibility on both sides. It's not just about the internet community providing greater access to people with disabilities. People with disabilities are part of that community, and that fraction is set to increase. And I think we need to take something away from this and not let this be the end of this discussion, because some of the things that have been said this afternoon are really quite interesting, and we really can't in 90 minutes even begin to even properly describe the problem, never mind begin to talk about the solutions.
Let me just make one other observation. It has been made earlier in the day, but it's very compelling. any technology which turns out to be useful to the general population and also happens to be useful to a population with special needs is likely to have a higher probability of persisting because it has a larger market. There's a corollary which I continue to wonder about. When I think about what my wife does with her cochlear implant, it occurs to me that it can be programmed to give her hearing which normal people don't have. It can be programmed to detect and relay to her frequencies that people normally can't hear. One can imagine similar kinds of capabilities that literally enhance normal people's ability to sense or to act. To give you one other example of that, there's a device made by a company called Intuitive Surgical. It's called the Da Vinci system. It interposes a computer between a surgeon and the patient. Now, anyone who writes software would be terrified, I think, at this thought. But what this device does is make it possible to do what's called minimally invasive surgery. Three devices are, and three incisions are made into the patient, two of them for manipulating devices, which are computer controlled, and one to provide a stereoscopic video image of the operating area. The surgeon sits with his head down in a special round space, which gives him a very, very good three-dimensional view of the operating space. And he has manipulators. Now, I actually got to use this thing. I didn't do anything to a patient. I sewed up an orange that had been sliced. It was very natural to use, but what was important is that any gross movements that I made could be stepped down by the computer to microscopic movements. There were even possibilities to prevent motion outside of a certain space so that you could prevent accidental cutting where you didn't, where you shouldn't. The reason I bring this up is that it's an example of how we can take normal skills and enhance them to become super normal. Things like that, which would be attractive to the general population, are also attractive to people who need augmentation because they have disabilities. So I look forward, frankly, to a very rich and future evolution of these kinds of technology, enhancement technologies, and a market space which is much larger than the disabled population.
Thanks, Vincent. We all have hope that all these technologies will emerge, all these and many others that will help all of us, with or without any sort of disability, to access all sort of contents and to have all sort of communications. In fact, I would say that today we're talking about a reverse type of internet evangelism. Normally what's done is trying to tell people how to teach people, to make them aware of the technologies that are there in order to repeat access contents or have different types of communications. Today we're pointing to the reverse part, is making aware of those that provide these technologies and these contents how they have to do their job in order to allow everybody, no matter how they want to interact with these contents and communications, their life easier. Thanks a lot for your assistance and for your comments, and very good luck to the World Blind Union. They're meeting us. The ICANN meeting is already over by now. Have a nice week here in Cape Town and enjoy the internet.
I'm Dave Williams, and you've been listening to ACB Radio's Main Menu. On behalf of all the ACB Radio team, thank you for all your support throughout 2004, and we look forward to seeing you again very soon in 2005. Best wishes for the season, and from me, Dave Williams, and all the team, bye for now.